A homily on negligence was given at the Holy Monastery of Philotheo. Gregory Palamas, the master of noetic and neptic labor, in his prayer always begged God to illumine his darkness, and indeed he received great illumination and became the man he became.
Let us also pray that God will illumine our spiritual darkness, that he will send us illumination, so that we may know and walk rightly the monastic path to which the great compassion of God has called us. Alongside this request, let us add this as well. Let us very fervently beg him every day in our prayer, that the end of our life may be Christian, painless, and unashamed, and that before the fearful judgment seat of our Christ, we may give a good defense. In the Gerontocon, it is written as follows: A young brother monk left the world, left his widowed mother, and followed the monastic path, and he went and lived alone somewhere, having only his spiritual guide. The devil assailed him with the microbe of negligence, and he was constantly losing ground. He constantly neglected his monastic duties. He reached a very bad state of negligence. God saw his disposition, saw that he had gone wrong in the spiritual steering of his soul, and he willed, by the following circumstance and event, to bring him to walk his duties rightly. And one day he saw that he was dying, that he had departed from life, and found himself in a place where there were very many souls, in the place of those being judged, in the place where there were souls that had not passed through the toll houses. Somewhere they had gotten stuck, and they were led to the place of those being judged. There the brother too found himself. Among the great throng there, among the many souls, he also saw his mother. As soon as his mother saw him, she says to him, "My child, have you come here too? When we were alive, you used to say to me, 'Mother, let me go and become a monk to save my soul.' And I would say to you that your father had died and that you were my only consolation. You will be the staff of the rest of my life, and yet you are thinking of abandoning me and going off to become a monk. Granted that you left and went so far as to leave us here in this state, this uncertain, difficult, already condemned state, did you not press me to let you go? Let me go, my mother, to become a monk, to save my soul, you would say to me. And now you have come to this wretched state, living here, where worldly life leads the life we lived in worldliness and sin. At that very moment, as he was enduring the fire of his mother's reproaches, his guardian angel took him and brought him back to life. Once he had come back to life, he began a very great struggle. He drove himself hard. The great fathers saw his change, and they grew afraid that he might now go to extremes. It has the same results. They spoke with him and counseled him to walk the middle way, the straight road, with neither excesses nor deficiencies. He would answer and say to them, "Fathers, if I could not bear the reproach of my mother, at that moment when God showed me this, I would have preferred, had the earth been open, to fall in and be lost, because it was exceedingly terrible for me to see my mother and to receive her reproaches. If I could not endure this reproof and this face, how much more will I be able to look upon the face of Christ and have him reprove my whole life?" And then the fathers thought they should give way, because this was something different, something exceptional, something God himself had brought about in this manner. And here, in the histories of the Holy Mountain, there was a certain brother who likewise, little by little, through the corrosion of negligence, came to unravel himself completely. He abandoned his duties. He did nothing at all. But an unraveling of this kind leads a person into very dangerous thoughts. Dangerous. He thought it over and decided to leave the Holy Mountain, go back out into the world, take off his monastic habit, and become a layman. "Look what you have come to," the devil would tell him. "What good does it do you to stay here, merely taking up space, when you think like a worldly man and do nothing befitting a monk? The worldly life is all that remains for you." And having made this decision, one day, and on a certain day, the very next morning, he was going to set out for the world. The prayers of holy people came in time, and that night, he sees the second coming of Christ taking place. He sees the heaven being rolled up like a scroll of paper, the heavenly bodies falling, the trumpets sounding, the dead rising, the fathers rising up from their graves, And then he also sees our most holy Theotokos visiting the holy mountain, every monastery, every sket, every hut, every cave, and the fathers now raised following her, and the Theotokos advancing toward the righteous judge who had come down with his angels and was about to hold judgment. And when our most holy Theotokos came forward, before the fearful judge, she knelt and begged him concerning the monks of her garden, that he would set them at his right hand. She interceded very powerfully, pleading that this garden is her inheritance, and that she had promised the fathers that all who repose on the holy mountain, in this land of her inheritance, she would set at the right hand of the judge. And upon this sight, the monk woke, came to himself, reflected, and said, "If I am found outside the holy mountain at the second coming, when the Theotokos will visit the holy mountain, and take the monks and set them at her right hand, at the right hand of the judge, then I will be outside the holy mountain. I will be a worldly man. I will be one who is lost, without any divine protection. Let me have patient endurance, for God showed me this so that I would force myself and make some beginning. What I cannot manage to accomplish, the intercession of the Theotokos will complete." His thoughts were kindled, his eagerness was stirred, and from the very next morning he began to keep his prayer rule and fulfill his monastic duties. Little by little he came to himself and became a monk in good standing. From these two incidents we see that negligence is a very great evil. It is a spiritual germ that poisons a person inwardly in his soul. It brings him to a point of inertia, so that he can do absolutely nothing. Little by little it assails him. Little by little it works its corrosion. Little by little it poisons his spiritual eagerness. It counsels him in the most perverse way, "Leave your rule of prayer," and so it begins its assault. "Today you cannot," it says, "you are tired, you are unwell. Come now, what harm is there in leaving your rule of prayer just this once?" And so the monk lets it go. He makes prayer difficult for him. The tongue cannot bring itself to say, "Lord Jesus Christ, have mercy." It turns aside here and there. It brings a kind of paralysis to his limbs, so that he cannot make his prostrations. When a person does not resist, when he does not force himself, the sinking begins at once, and little by little, one thing drawing on the next, he comes to a state of captivity, and that captivity will bring its consequences. That is why we must always keep our readiness alive. With good thoughts, with good reflections, listening to the counsels of the elder, not letting our life go slack, tightening ourselves with spiritual force, giving the devil no part of our nose, no part of our heart. Ugly thoughts assail us. Evil imaginations give birth to evil logismoi. When we neglect to drive away the sinful images of sin, filthy thoughts will follow. The thoughts of sin will begin to corrode our purity. The soul loses its purity, and along with the soul the body too loses it, becomes defiled, becomes unclean before the eyes of God. And when this yielding to the imaginations, to the shameful thoughts, to the various defilements of heart and body takes hold, a person ends up a captive, the plaything of the devil and of the flesh. And once the passion becomes the master of a person, he is swept along without resistance toward whatever the devil devises to destroy him. We must beg God continually to give us a spirit of readiness, a fighting spirit, a spirit of nepsis, watchfulness, so that we guard our thoughts and our feelings, and unceasing attentiveness must govern our nous and our heart. The nous must remain watchful when the passion approaches and brings images that are intensely vivid, richly colored, and filled with carnal pleasure. It must immediately drive them away, destroy them, and move the soul to prayer. If we struggle in this way, then our soul remains untouched, remains unwounded, immune to the poison of sin. The first assault is not sin, but from the very next step, the one called coupling, the soul begins to take on guilt. From that coupling onward, the soul begins to receive defilement. Nepsis, watchfulness, will help us to hold the evil back at the first assault, to meet the various experiences without yielding to the passions. In that first assault, when a person conquers sin, he is crowned. A disciple saw that a great father of the desert was feared by the demons and cast them out with great ease from those who were suffering, So he asked him, "Why do the demons fear you, elder?" The elder replied, "I will tell you, my child. I have nothing good in me, but all my life I have been assailed by evil thoughts, yet by the grace of God I have never yielded to them. Never did the thoughts advance to coupling. I always hold them at the first assault, and for this reason the demons fear me." Negligence toward the thoughts brings every evil upon a person. If we allow the logismoi, the intrusive thoughts, to rule our nous then the consequences will follow. The results of giving way like this will be grievous, sorrowful, and wretched. From that point on, one can imagine anything happening. When a river's embankment breaks, the water rushes down and sweeps away everything in its path. Nothing is left standing. So, too, the rush of the passions, through negligence, levels whatever good a person has within him. Then a person grows careless in his thoughts, in his notions, in his feelings, in his tongue, in the actions of the body. A general spiritual erosion sets in. Since then, negligence does such great harm. We must open the eyes of our soul and set the most firm resolve and decision to struggle against this great evil. We must set a ruling thought in our noose, that I must not yield to the evil imaginations, to the evil thoughts, that I will not let pleasure assault the feelings of the heart. If, at the very moment of the first assault, we discipline our body, for this is how sin usually comes, stirring up, warming, and inflaming the heart and the body, and so pushing a person towards sin. Because of this pleasure that the assault brings, we must chastise our body. If we pay back that pleasure that arises during the assault, then we are not guilty, or rather we owe no sinful pleasure before the eyes of God. When we do this, the body has every right to ask purity of God.
Purity.
Let us be watchful in our lives and in our conduct, taking care with our speech, so that no words escape our lips, that wound our brother, words that do not express love and respect. As we have said here before, our fathers were always careful not to wound one another. In their words, in their manner, and in their conduct. Their aim, however, was always to build up their brother in the best possible way. For many times, on this very point, the devil deceives us. We grow bitter toward one another. We scandalize one another through this carelessness. Let us take care to keep the commandments laid down for us by the elder, our spiritual father. Let us not transgress them, because these commandments are intended to bring us to spiritual maturity, to help the brotherhood function better, to safeguard our souls, to ward off the demons, and to destroy the snares of the devil. But when we do not keep the commandments, when we do not heed his admonitions, his exhortations, his counsels, the devil does his work very well. Let us beg God to grant us nepsis, watchfulness, and attentiveness, to grant us prophecy on our spiritual road, and to help us keep our obedience with exactness. By failing to keep obedience, we break the counsels given to us. Of course, everyone finds it hard to keep something because the devil always attacks the good. He does not want it to happen. He does not want anything to be done for the glory of God. He wants everything for his own glory. He goes about inside the monasteries and stirs up the brothers like a ladle. He seizes on the weak points, on the weaker brothers, and does his work. He creates scandals, and so he writes up quite a lot in his various charge books. We must understand this and take it to heart, and we must be careful not to become a cause of stumbling to the brethren. Whatever the elder commands must be observed. It is the will of God. It is the salvation of our soul. That is why we came here. We came for nothing else. We came to change. We came to gain something that out in the world we could not obtain. Many times the tongue reveals what a person has within him. Monks in their manners have always been most gracious. That is why all slander and every careless word must cease. The tongue must not go astray, because it spreads the germs of corruption. Another brother hears it and is scandalized. A lay person hears it too and says, "Look, even the monks have no good manners." We must become a pattern of benefit, edifying the people who come to the monastic life. In monasticism. When the Venerable Zosimas met St. Mary of Egypt, the Holy One said to him, "Abba Zosimas, when you return to the monastery, tell the abbot to take heed and to correct certain scandals that are happening in his monastery." Therefore, the abbot is the one directly responsible for everything that happens, and he bears an enormous responsibility before God when he does not step in and correct the various things that take place. That is why I counsel you, and why I sometimes find it necessary to lay down certain rules. There is no other reason. God knows how much I love you and how deeply I desire the salvation of your souls. When I repeatedly offer guidance and see that nothing is being corrected, I am brought to the point I never wish to reach. I must issue a command and impose a strict prohibition. I do not want to resort to this measure, but they compel me, because some do not respond to words, and so I arrive at this point. If there is compliance with the first and second admonition, there is no need to speak of a command or a strict prohibition, and everything we say and every admonition we give here aims at one thing, that we become better, that we become good monks, that we save our soul, that we help our parents, that we help our own households, that we help the world with our prayers. For, if we become spiritually advanced monks, our prayers will have boldness before God, and this boldness will help the world which is in such great need. If the world has always had this need, how much greater it is today, when the world desperately needs spiritual people who have boldness before God and can hold back his chastisement. There must be spiritual people who can entreat God and hold back his chastisement. What we say here, we say out of much love, out of duty, and out of the fear of God. First of all, that I myself may not lose my own soul by overlooking certain things that harm the whole brotherhood, while at the same time these people may fail to be saved, which would be a great tragedy. So, once again, I ask, I plead that my admonitions and my commands be kept. It is not I whom you benefit by keeping them. You will help me spiritually so that I may feel at ease with you and rejoice in your progress. But if you keep these counsels, it is you who will be crowned as obedient ones who sacrificed everything, and your dearest ones as well, for the sake of the love of God and of obedience. And the crown of honor and glory most certainly awaits you. And I, for my part, will have a praise to the glory of God that these people were led close to God with such glory. But if you do not keep them, if you are not saved after so many admonitions, then I remain without blame. If I have admonished you, if I have laid something upon you out of necessity, I will be freed of responsibility, but you will become wretched. So do not misjudge me when at times I am forced to intervene somewhat. It is not harshness, for the person who has every willingness to render obedience, this is a joy to him. Suppose some strictness has come in, some prohibition. The strictness and the command do not trouble him, because he feels no urge to transgress the command. Since it is an ordinance of the elder, it simply has to be carried out. From then on, there is no difficulty at all. The difficulty lies with the person who does not want to be obedient. There is a command from God that we not hate one another. The one who loves has no difficulty with this command of God. I feel love for my brother. Whether the command exists or not, it does not trouble me. But when I feel the need to take revenge on my brother, on my neighbor, because he has wronged me in some way, then the commandment concerns me, because it does not allow me to take revenge. At this point, we must pay close attention to our conscience. When we commit a transgression against obedience, the elder does not see it. He is not everywhere present, as God is. But God, as the spirit who cannot be contained, is present everywhere. Not only within the cell, not only within the person, but deeper still than the person, God is within his very bones, and he knows all things. When we transgress against obedience, it is God whom we disobey. God will judge, God will reward or condemn. Through his counsel and protection, the elder simply interprets God's will for us. For keeping obedience, God will grant praise, and for doing the opposite, the opposite. Let us pay attention to our conscience and not offend it. Let us not wound it, bury it, or deaden it by refusing to obey it. The conscience points us, like a signpost and a compass, toward what God wills. Let us not transgress our conscience, and I am the first who commits such transgressions, and I acknowledge them and confess them. But let us all together take care to keep our conscience rightly regarding our duties. Let us know that the elder does not see me at this hour when I am in my cell, when I am alone, but God is with me. I breathe him in and I breathe him out. He is present as spirit, awesome and absolute, beyond our understanding. God is incomprehensible by nature. He knows all things, and nothing escapes his notice. Everything lies bare before his eyes, as though an awesome and divine mirror stood before us, reflecting everything in the depths of our hearts. This awareness we must keep in all our works, and in all our logismoi, intrusive thoughts, and in our thinking. And when we think in this way about God, When each of us is off by himself and thinks whatever he pleases, let us hold to the mindfulness that God sees everything. Let us take care with our obedience, for which we will give the first account at the hour of the fearful judgment. I will give as my first account how I governed you. You will give how you obeyed. So receive my counsels and my commands as an expression of fatherly and complete love, of care and of duty, and once again I will turn to counsel, that we may be able to become better. Death awaits us. From the moment these fleshly eyes close at once of themselves, the eyes of the soul open, and we will behold a whole spiritual world like the infant that lies within its mother's womb. It does not see what is happening outside the womb, what exists there. A world, there are things, there is light, there is a sun, there are stars, there are so many and so many good things, and this one lives within the darkness of the womb. So too we, who live in this material world, do not know what exists outside this womb of the world, of matter, that there is an unimaginable spiritual world which will be revealed to us the instant the fleshly eyes close. And then we will find ourselves before a spiritual world, and our mind too will take on dimensions of gravity, and then the thoughts will come to us, if we did not press ourselves in time, what have I done? I failed. Now what becomes of me? But now you cannot turn back, O man. The infant cannot re-enter its mother's womb. It has come out. Whether we want to or not, let us follow these teachings and put them into practice, so that God may rejoice in us, the angels may rejoice, and the fathers who laid the foundations of monasticism may rejoice. Let the institution of monasticism be held in honor, and let us not be blamed as monasticism is blamed in the world, unjustly, of course. Even so, certain tasks are laid upon us. Let us strive not to become a cause of scandal, but a cause of benefit and edification. Let us beseech God to illumine our darkness. Let us beseech Him that the end of our life may be blessed and close to God, and let us beseech Him also for our parents, and beseech Him also for the world, that they too may attain salvation.